as Lisa Lampanelli at the theater at Westbury.
At the local 269, it's Aqua Cherry.
And that show is happening at 10 p.m. And if you're a local venue, band, or promoter, and you want to get your gigs listed on the concert billboard, send an email to Scene, that's S-C-E-N-E, at WUSB.FM. And as always, thanks for listening to the concert billboard right here on 90.1 FM WUSB in
Stony Brook.
And it's 3 minutes after 6 o'clock on a Tuesday evening. Time once again for Off the Wall. All right, the program is Off the Wall. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you on this Tuesday evening, where we once again take a look at what's been happening in the world and open up our phone lines for you to comment on whatever might be affecting or concerning you. And let's hope last week was an exception. Everybody was in some kind of collective coma, and that this week we'll actually get some more phone calls. I think we had, what, one last week? Embarrassing. We can do better. I'm sick of saying that, you know. I always seem to be saying that to everybody. We can do better. We don't have to define ourselves by the utter garbage that's around us all the time, by the stupidity, by the lack of movement, lack of progress. That's not us. We can do better. But even I get impatient sometimes, wondering, just when exactly is that going to be? You know, what is it going to take? And I think it's going to take a few raised voices, perhaps, some gesturing, and I guess a lack of fear of discussing things, discussing issues, because we seem to always be backing away from that. And that's never a good thing. In fact, that's a surefire recipe for things to go exactly the opposite direction of where they should be going. And we're starting to see a lot of that. Yeah, okay, well, let's jump right in and see what's been happening in the world. We had the State of the Union address last Wednesday. That was mildly entertaining. But, you know, it's it leads me to believe that there are so many people out there that for one reason or another want things to fail, want things not to work out because, well, either we return back to the way things were and get a right-wing arch-conservative in power and basically go back to the policies of the past, or we get to whine and moan and say, wow, things never go our way, and look, here's proof. I don't know which is worse, actually. I really don't, if it's the right wing or the left wing, because they both are really pissing me off at the moment. They really are. The left wing has opportunities that they are simply throwing away and wasting so much time bitching and moaning about things that only in your wildest imaginations would you expect change as quickly as they demand change. It doesn't happen like that. You have to work towards these things. Now, the right wing, yeah, they annoy me too, but they don't surprise me. It's exactly the kind of thing that I expect to hear, I expect to see. And I'll say this, if you reach your conclusions, not by blind repetition and by following party lines, but by actual logic and by rationalizing in your own mind, having a step-by-step process where you get to the conclusion, if you have that, it doesn't really matter if we disagree, because we respect the process that led us to different conclusions. What I don't respect on either end are people that just blindly follow. And I see so much of that. I mean, and right now I see more of it obviously on the right, because that's where a lot of the yelling and screaming is going on, without really paying attention to the points. Anyway, let's look at some issues that have been going on. One of the things in the State of the Union address that was mentioned was repealing Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And today, the Pentagon has taken the first steps towards repealing the controversial Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy that basically is regarding gay and lesbian service members in the military. Now, Defense Secretary Robert Gates today laid the groundwork for that repeal, said it'll take more than a year. Now, you see, this is a typical point that I would have issue with the left wing, or certain aspects of the left wing, saying, why can't it be right now? Why can't it be today? Not realizing that it takes time to change things. You can't just snap your fingers and have it all done. They want Iraq to be over. They want Afghanistan to never have started. They want Don't Ask, Don't Tell to end immediately. They want Guantanamo Bay to be closed yesterday. And they want health care. You know, I want all of those things. But somehow, you know, you can't blame the people in power who are trying to do all these things and being fought left and right. Literally left and right. And then wondering why it doesn't happen. So yeah, this is a good thing. Those of you who agree with it. And yeah, it would have been nice if it happened in the past. Would have been nice if there was never a policy to start with. But you know what? That's reality. That's what it was. So let's deal with that. Move on. And accept the progress before it gets taken away from us. And it will get taken away from us if we continue to do all this infighting and factionalism, which I see everywhere. Anyway, Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman Admiral Mike Mullen also endorsed a repeal today, telling the committee they were speaking in front of that it is his personal belief that allowing gays and lesbians to serve openly in the military would be the right thing to do. For me personally, it comes down to integrity. the question before us is not whether the... actually, Gates is saying this now. The question before us is not whether the military prepares to make the change, but how best to prepare for it. We have received our orders from the commander-in-chief, and we are moving out accordingly. But that ultimate decision rests with our friends in Congress, the people who have basically kept all the progress from happening and threatened to drive us back into the Dark Ages. Now, the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy enacted under President Clinton back in 1993, and yeah, if you want to accuse somebody of being wishy-washy, go there. He kowtowed to the right wing more than any Democrat president that I can remember. But that policy bars openly gay, lesbian, and bisexual individuals from serving in the U.S. military, but prevents the military from asking a service member's sexual orientation. Yeah. But, you know, there's all kinds of other ways to find out. And if you find out, then you can take action and kick them out. I see a lot of the reaction to this on some of the right-wing networks and various forums on the internet. You do have to look at these things occasionally to see just how ugly it gets. And there are people there who are claiming to be in the military saying they'll resign their post if they start letting gays in. Well, you know, guess what? They're in already. They're all around you. You just don't know who they are. Because they're forced to keep their lives secret. People are actually saying stupid things like, well, we'll have to have separate bathrooms. We'll have to have a gay bathroom and a straight bathroom and different showers and different dormitories. In other words, we're going to have four times as many facilities. And I don't think the U.S. military can afford this. These arguments are being taken seriously. So expect all kinds of nonsense to be happening in the weeks ahead as this policy starts to be taken apart, as it, well, should have been back in 1993. It never should have happened. So rather than bemoan the fact that it's there in the first place and that Obama doesn't have the ability to snap his fingers and make it go away immediately, or that he didn't start this process the day after he took office, why don't we simply stand up and say this is the right thing to do and take on those people who disagree? Because if you don't do that, the people who disagree are going to have the only voices that will be heard, or certainly the voices that will predominate. And that's what's been happening. That's what's happened with health care. That's what's happening with Guantanamo Bay and all kinds of other issues that have been in the news in the last year. The louder you speak, the more attention gets focused on you. Right or wrong. And that's pretty much how the seat in Massachusetts was lost, and maybe the seat in Illinois will be lost as well. Political analysts say it might be an uphill climb for the Democrats to hold on to Barack Obama's former Senate seat in Illinois. Democrats right now are in disarray, said Russ Stewart, a longtime Illinois political analyst and columnist. Today is the primary for that election. And, you know, if they blow it again, like they did in Massachusetts, they do that in Illinois, then, you know, it's really starting to all fall apart. Before you know it, they won't even have a majority in the Senate, let alone not have a supermajority. Here's a fascinating piece that I saw in the BBC. This appeared on their website. It's called "Why Do People Vote Against Their Own Interests?" And I'd like to read this because I think it just addresses so many interesting points, so many things that I try to say that this person just says in such a better way, I believe. The Republicans' shock victory in the election for the U.S. Senate seat in Massachusetts meant the Democrats lost their supermajority in the Senate. This makes it even harder for the Obama administration to get health care reform passed in the U.S. Political scientist Dr. David Runciman is a person that we're going to be reading words from here. He's basically analyzing why there is often such deep opposition to reforms that appear to be of obvious benefit to voters. Last year, in a series of town hall meetings across the country, Americans got the chance to debate President Obama's proposed health care reforms. What happened was an explosion of rage and barely suppressed violence. Polling evidence suggests that the numbers who think the reforms go too far are nearly matched by those who think they don't go far enough. But it's striking that the people who most dislike the whole idea of health care reform, the ones who think it is socialist, godless, a step on the road to a police state, they're often the ones it seems designed to help. In Texas, where barely two-thirds of the population have full health insurance and over a fifth of all children have no coverage at all, opposition to the legislation is currently running at 87%. 87%! Instead, to many of those who lose out under the existing system, reform still seems like the ultimate betrayal. Why are so many American voters enraged by attempts to change a horribly inefficient system that leaves them with premiums they often can't afford? Why are they manning the barricades to defend insurance companies that routinely deny claims and cancel policies? It might be tempting to put the whole thing down to what the historian Richard Hofstadter back in the 1960s called the paranoid style of American politics, in which God, guns, and race get mixed into a toxic stew of resentment at anything coming out of Washington. But that would be a mistake. If people vote against their own interests, it is not because they do not understand what is in their interest or have not yet had it properly explained to them. They do it because they resent having their interests decided for them by politicians who think they know best. There is nothing voters hate more than having things explained to them as though they were idiots. As the saying goes, in politics, when you are explaining, you are losing. And that makes anything as complex or as messy as health care reform a very hard sell. In his book, The Political Brain, psychologist Drew Weston, an exasperated Democrat, tried to show why the right often wins the argument, even when the left is confident that it has the facts on its side. He uses the following exchange from the first presidential debate between Al Gore and George Bush in 2000 to illustrate the perils of trying to explain to voters what will make them better off. Now here's what Gore said. Under the governor's plan, if you kept the same fee for services that you have now under Medicare, your premiums would go up between 18 and 47%, and that is a study of the congressional plan that he's modeled his proposal on by the Medicare actuaries. Bush responded to that by saying, "Look, this is a man who has great numbers. He talks about numbers. I'm beginning to think not only did he invent the internet, but he invented the calculator. It's fuzzy math. It's trying to scare people in the voting booth." Now, Mr. Gore was talking sense and Mr. Bush nonsense, but Mr. Bush won the debate. With statistics, the voters just hear a patronizing policy wonk and switch off. For Mr. Weston, stories always trump statistics, which means the politician with the best stories is going to win. One of the fallacies that politicians often have on the left is that things are obvious when they are not obvious. Obama's administration made a tremendous mistake by not immediately branding the economic collapse that we had just had as the Republicans' depression, caused by the Bush administration's ideology of unregulated greed. The result is that now people blame him. Thomas Frank, the author of the best-selling book What's the Matter with Kansas, is an even more exasperated Democrat, and he goes further than Mr. Weston. He believes that the voters' preference for emotional engagement over reasonable argument has allowed the Republican Party to blind them to their own interests. The Republicans have learned how to stoke up resentment against a patronizing liberal elite, all those do-gooders who assume they know what poor people ought to be thinking. Right-wing politics has become a vehicle for channeling this popular anger against intellectual snobs. The result is that many of America's poorest citizens have a deep emotional attachment to a party that serves the interests of its richest. Thomas Frank says that whatever disadvantage Americans think they are voting for, they get something quite different. You vote to strike a blow against elitism, and you receive a social order in which wealth is more concentrated than ever before in our lifetimes. Workers have been stripped of power, and CEOs are rewarded in a manner that is beyond imagining. It's like a French Revolution in reverse, in which the workers come pouring down the streets screaming more power to the aristocracy. As Mr. Frank sees it, authenticity has replaced economics as the driving force of modern politics. The authentic politicians are the ones who sound like they are speaking from the gut, not the cerebral cortex. Of course, they might be faking it, but it's no joke to say that in contemporary politics, if you can fake sincerity, you've got it made. And the ultimate sin in modern politics is appearing to take the voters for granted. This is a culture war, but it is not simply being driven by differences over abortion, religion, or patriotism. And it's not simply red states versus blue states anymore. It's a war on the entire political culture, on the arrogance of politicians, on their slipperiness and lack of principle, on their endless deal-making and compromises. And when politicians say to the people protesting, "But we're doing this for you," that just makes it worse. In fact, that seems to be what makes them angriest of all. Well, those words from Dr. David Runciman, as found on the BBC, really, really lays it all out for you. It's incredible to me how this whole healthcare thing has not been resolved after all this time. And, you know, I see people on the left blaming Obama for not getting it through. You know, if he was a king, perhaps he could do this, but he's not. He's a politician. He's a president. There's checks and balances. And you have these people known as congresspeople that get in the way. Rightly or wrongly, that's what they do. And by misrepresenting the situation and making people afraid, and certainly by the Democrats messing up on a number of occasions in the way they present themselves, something that seems so obviously a good thing is being fought tooth and nail. And after the election results in Massachusetts, it may never happen. And you certainly can't blame Obama for this, even though everybody's trying to. You know, I basically ask a couple of questions with regard to healthcare. People who are insistent that this is a bad idea, that healthcare reform will never work. The questions I ask are these. Will you be able to be denied coverage by your current insurance company or by a new insurance company because of a pre-existing condition? And if you get catastrophically ill for whatever reason, could you possibly lose your home because of the medical bills that you have to pay? And if the answer to either of those questions, and in most cases I think it would be yes to both of them, if that is the case, then how can you defend a system like this? And if the proposed reforms change the answer to either of those questions, or hopefully both of those questions, to no, you cannot be turned down because of a pre-existing condition, and no, you will not lose your home because you can't pay your medical bills, how could that not be worth pursuing? Even if, and I say if it raises your taxes, and the jury's out on that, if it raises your taxes, you know, I'd pay a lot more for that kind of security, but I don't think they're even talking about raising taxes by very much, if at all. But you see the people who are most angry about this, and they seem to think that these death panels will be formed, and all kinds of new fees will be instituted, and the government will basically have the final say on everything. I don't think anyone is ever going to stand in the way of somebody paying as much as they want to for medical care, or going to a different insurance company. I think that's always going to be a possibility. So what is so wrong with having this as the backdrop for everybody so that nobody has to lose their home and nobody has to go without coverage? That's the question I ask. And that's the question we all should be asking. Rather than nitpicking over how much is being spent here and there and who's being talked to and all that nonsense, those are the two simple issues. If those two things are resolvable now as a result of reform, then reform is a good thing. If they're not, in all fairness, if all this reform doesn't give us that assurance, then, yeah, you know what, we got to go back and get it right, because it's pointless otherwise. So, you know, I wish those are the issues that that we could see be debated and discussed more. Would certainly educate more people, I believe. But like I said, you know, you can reach different conclusions as long as you're thinking about this. And you know why. Not just because somebody says so. Not just because you heard about it on a radio program or your favorite politician or TV star said so. Because you're basing it on facts. Because you're doing some reading. And you're reading the other side as well. And you're not simply dismissing everything they say out of hand. You're considering what they say before you dismiss it. And then if you reach a different conclusion, fine. At least you've done the work. And so many people are just skipping over that part. I'll prove it to you. There's this case that basically puts me at odds with everybody that I normally agree with. This actually happens quite a lot. But I agree with many liberal causes. But I don't like to take shortcuts. I don't like to reach conclusions just because everybody else has reached the same conclusion. Now, last week we talked about this strange story out of New Orleans. We didn't know much about it at the time. Nothing was being reported. Just basically four guys had apparently broken into a senator's office and were trying to tap phones or something crazy like that. Turns out, yeah, there was more to this story. We talked about it a little bit on Off the Hook last week. This was basically a group of four people, one of whom was a videographer named James O'Keefe. He basically was responsible for those videos that involved Acorn, which you've probably heard the name Acorn, which is basically an organization that goes out and gets people registered to vote and does all kinds of, I think, good things for poor, disenfranchised people. But, and this is where I kind of veer off the path I'm supposed to be on, those videos did reveal that at best they hire some real morons, because the video, even though the video is very heavily edited, and I think that the unedited version should certainly be seen, and if it hasn't already, I can't imagine why it wouldn't have been. But in this video, basically, you see somebody pretending to be a prostitute and basically a pimp going around asking for tax advice from these people and getting advice on how to cover up income, how prostitution is actually an art form, so you could deduct taxes based on that, and how you can import all these kids from El Salvador that are sex workers, but as long as they're under 16, you don't have to declare them. Things like that. Really stupid things. Now, does that represent Acorn? No, of course not. But the fact that that these kind of people seem to be working for them, and there isn't much vetting going on as far as making sure the people who are working for you are qualified, you couple that with all of the fake names that were turned in by other Acorn workers, you couple that with a $1 million embezzlement that was not reported to authorities because it was the brother of the founder, and then another investigation for $5 million of embezzlement, you know what? Acorn doesn't look so good. And you have to look at that. You have to accept that fact. Now, the swiftness with which authorities tried to cut off funding to them and every politician distanced themselves from Acorn, that is not really the coolest thing in the world. But you have to realize that these are politicians, and nobody wants to be caught affiliated with a suspicious organization, even if the suspicions turn out to be mostly unfounded or the exception rather than the rule. You can't be surprised by this. And you can't take the high and mighty stance that these guys were breaking the law by recording people without permission. You know, because it's hypocritical because we would not be saying this if this was some kind of undercover news investigation which was revealing racism or an unfair way of treating a certain class of people or a ripoff by some corporation or somebody recording a policeman doing something bad. We would all be standing up defending this. Instead, what I see are the same people who do this saying, well, they violated the law by recording them. They should be prosecuted for that. Nonsense. That is nonsense. We don't agree with the conclusion they reached. We don't agree with the people that... we don't agree that they should be targeting the people they targeted. But they chose to. And it's so hypocritical for us to believe that the law applies one way to one group of people if we agree with them, and a different way to different people if we don't agree with them. And then the same thing we see with what happened in New Orleans. Basically, what happened here was that these four guys went into the senator's office, ostensibly to tamper with the telephone system of Senator Mary Landrieu, who's a Democratic senator from Louisiana. Two of them were impersonating repairmen in the senator's New Orleans office and were caught after being asked for identification. Now, James O'Keefe released a statement on Friday saying the four men had been trying to determine whether Ms. Landrieu was avoiding constituent complaints about the Senate health care bill after her phone system was jammed in December. Her office said no calls have been intentionally avoided. On reflection, he said in the statement, I could have used a different approach to this investigation. So basically what you have here, with what we know so far, is not so much a case where somebody is planting bugs in the phone system, but has come into the office to see if phone calls are being received. And not doing the slickest job of that either. Because one of them was holding a cell phone recording these guys going around looking at the phones. So imagine that. You hear somebody might be up to something, and you basically sneak into their office while they're open, not at night when they're closed, to see if what they say is actually true. It's undercover reporting, basically. Now, of course, people on the left are saying, oh, what they did was they committed a felony because they entered a federal building under false pretenses. Yeah. Now, since when did federal buildings become holy shrines that you can't enter unless you have the purest of intentions? basically, and I don't think they even lied going into the federal building. I'm not sure. I don't go into federal buildings on a normal basis, but if you go in there, you have to probably sign one of those little books that say who you're there to see. And I'll bet they signed the senator's name, which is true. That is who they were there to see. Now, they pretended they were repairmen. Okay. I don't know if they pretended they were particular types of repairmen. You can get away with that simply by saying, yeah, we didn't pretend to be with AT&T or whatever phone company is down there. Instead, they simply walked into the office and took some pictures and tried to find that information. And if that's all it is, again, I don't know for sure if there was more. If there was more, they actually were trying to tamper with the phones, disconnect phones or plan things on phones. That's more serious, no question about that. But if all they did was walk into a building, which they have every right to walk into, federal buildings are not these temples that we should not be allowed in unless we have permission. People used to go and visit their senators all the time. Elected officials, we should have the right to do that. Do we not have the right to do that in other buildings? Federal buildings should be no different than any other building. I don't know why we have this in our minds that these buildings have to be protected more than anything else. Yeah, they blew one up. Okay. You know, some right-wing extremists blew up a federal building once. Doesn't mean that everybody's going to be trying to do that. Just like not everybody is going to try to bring down an airplane as it's landing. it's our way of dealing with things. That once something happens, it can only happen the same way again, and that's where we have to focus all of our attention. No, it's not that way. Federal buildings should be as open as any other building. And then going into an office, you know, I've gone into many offices I have not had permission to go inside. I've walked into offices and said, hey, is this person here? Can I see this person? Do you have an appointment? No, I don't. Of course, on TV, it always goes, well, sir, you can't just walk right in there. And then they walk into the guy's office. The guy says, it's okay, Eleanor, I'll talk to him. You know, it always works that way on television. Those aren't felonies. Those are just basically human interactions. None of that happened here. Basically, somebody just walked into an office that they weren't supposed to be in, and the office people didn't check their credentials. They checked their credentials, found out they weren't supposed to be there, you kick them out, you tell security, escort them out of the building, don't let them come back in. That's it. Instead, you have this crazy story, and people that normally are somewhat rational saying, well, you know what, they broke and entered a federal building. Breaking and entering now. Now it's called breaking and entering. If you walk into a building in the middle of the day, if you don't have permission. I mean, why are we buying into this? This is nonsense. So, yeah, you know, I don't agree with the conclusions in most cases. I don't agree that ACORN is a bad organization. And the evidence is out on whether or not this senator was blocking phone calls or ignoring them. But the method is something that I think we all would sort of give a thumbs up to if it was something that resulted in a good conclusion for us. So it's wrong for us to basically treat this any other way. So that's an example. That's an example of how you don't have to follow the party line all the time. You don't have to blindly believe everything just because it goes in a particular direction. There are exceptions. All right. We have other business to do, and we do want to take some phone calls. First, okay, before we do anything, we have to do this. Oh, boy, here they come again. Oh, am I supposed to be talking? I'm sorry. I was just watching the dancers. I'm sorry. I realize time is pressing here. So basically, this is the it's so spectacular. You know. Thank you. Thank you very much. Okay, you can sit down while we just do the second installment of this. This is the quest for Starbucks, by the way. Very quickly, I'm narrowing down the first Starbucks I ever visited in my life, where we basically whittled the list down to 8,192 last week, and this week, okay, you with the drum over there. Okay, we're going to do this. Okay, we have a computer program, we have a randomizing application, we have the list of 8,192 possible Starbucks that will be my first to venture to at a later date, and I am pressing the execute button, and here we go. Oh, wow. Hey, that sounded pretty good. Nice, very nice. Actual drum roll in the studio. Okay, well, the list has just been cut in half. It's been randomized and cut in half. We now have a potential of 4,096 potential Starbucks. And okay, there they go again. Yeah, not much in the way of drama or action, but well, look at it this way. We just cut 5,000 at least potential Starbucks from being the first that I'll enter. And now it's down to 4,096. For the next few weeks, it's going to be a little bit uh, dull, as because we can't read off the names of these potential ones. But as it gets closer to the final list, it'll get a lot more interesting. It really will. Oh, be careful. You almost, almost knocked over a speaker. It's, I thought I could describe the scene here. It's the traditional dress and the whirling around. And in the conference room, it's so nice. Let's hope that that table holds up. Wow. I'm so impressed. The thing that I don't realize is that, what I don't understand is why are we going through all this trouble? It's you do realize that people out there can't see you, right? I'm not trying to embarrass you, but but they can't. It's radio, and they left. Okay, well, I don't know who plans these things, but it's a good idea. It is a good idea. All right, we have something from last week, that unfinished business from last week. Do you remember we started looking at this Phone Company album, and I inadvertently played a song that I was supposed to play the song, but I inadvertently referred to it as a song from 1899. And in fact, it was a song from 1899, but it wasn't the version from 1899. And I swore, I vowed, that I would go out and I'd find the 1899 version of this song. And I did. I did. Now, basically, the song is called Hello, Ma Baby. Yeah. And the version we played last week was actually recorded in the 70s, the 1970s. So it didn't sound anything like something that might have come from the 1800s. And I was a bit sad by that. But what we did was we searched around, and yes, these things can be found if you simply look for them. The song was written in 1899 by the team of Joseph Howard and Ida Emerson, and it was recorded by Arthur Collins. Arthur Collins. He was an American singer who recorded a significant amount of early records. And this was recorded in 1899. Let's listen.
Hello, the baby, sung by Arthur Collins. Hello, hello, Stephen, hello. Please don't cut me off anyway. Hello, hello, what a hello. I've got a little baby, but she's out of sight. I talk to her across the telephone. I've never seen money, but she's mine, all right. So take my kids and leave the cat alone. Every single morning you will hear me yell. Hey, Central, take me out along the line. He connects me with my honey, then I ring the bell. And this is what I say to baby mine. Hello, my baby, hello, my honey, hello. My ragtime gal, send me a kiss, my wife. You hear me, baby? My heart one time. If you refuse me, honey, you lose me. Then you'll be left alone. Oh, baby, telephone and tell me I'm alone. Hello, hello, baby, hello. I guess you don't hear me. The wires must be crossed somewhere. Hello, hello.
Yeah, okay, there you go. Arthur Collins from 1899. You know, it would be great if we could get this guy to do that song for The Next Hope in July. We could. Oh, really? Oh, okay. That's sad. I didn't know that. All right, well, we can get somebody else then to maybe do that song, because it's historic. You know, it has to do with phones back in the 1800s. This is from, was not from the album that we're featuring over the next few weeks. Good Friends Are for Keeps, the 100th year celebration album of the phone company. The telephone kindled a new round of awe and excitement in 1892 as the long lines reached Chicago from New York just in time for the opening of the fabulous Columbian Exposition. And songwriters were quick to note that a telephonic kiss could now be sent this incredible distance. Howard and Emerson's Lonesome Lover in Hello, My Baby requests a much warmer kiss by wire. And in this next song from the album, Dinah Shore, perhaps describing the effects of that kiss, longs for a ring, a ring-a-ling, in Irving Berlin's simple and touching 1924 ballad, All Alone. Let's go back to vinyl and hear that. So many good songs about phones out there that I didn't know about. Dinah Shore, All Alone, the Irving Berlin song, written in 1924. And next week we'll feature another one. We do have a little bit of time for phone calls. What I'm going to do is read a little blurb here and advise people to call 631-632-9872, 631-632-WUSB. I'm going to read a couple of paragraphs. If I look down at the phone at the end of that and see the phone ringing, then we'll go to phone calls. Otherwise, we'll go to letters. Yeah, feedback one way or another. Long-distance service between New York and Chicago was offered in 1892. This was an overhead wire line. Alexander Graham Bell took part in the opening ceremony at AT&T offices in New York. In 1895, number please became the official words to be used by operators in taking a call. Prior to this, the response was usually, hello, or what do you want? Or anything else that struck the operator as appropriate. The basic long-distance toll period was reduced from 5 minutes to 3 minutes in 1899 for points west of Pittsburgh. The same change was made for points east of Pittsburgh in 1901. Well, I'm sorry to say the phone is not ringing, so we are not going to go to delay today. It's just the way it goes. We'll try to take calls earlier next week and see maybe if that results in more people. Sad, I like to hear our listeners' voices, but they're not out there. What can I say? Either that or our phones aren't working, which is kind of ironic, I suppose. Dear Emmanuel, I just got around to listening to the retrospective show you produced on December 22nd. I just want to say I liked it so much I decided to do something like this for my own personal enjoyment. It was a goal of mine to start producing a radio show of my own, albeit a podcast, last year, and it is something I would like to move forward with this year. Thanks for all the great ideas and inspiration you've given me over the years of listening. I have to say, there are few people in my life I can agree with almost 100% on almost every issue, but you are one. Ho-ho, that kind of scares me. Thanks again. I'm definitely looking forward to hope in every sense of the word. Signed, Brian. Brian, thanks for your kind letter. And yes, I see the phone calls coming in. Too late. Too late. We don't have enough time. It's partially my fault. I ranted and raved for a while, and maybe next week at the half-hour point, I'll give out the phone number, and we can see if more people call in. But, yeah, we just don't have enough time. It's our biggest enemy. But we do have time for letters, and you can write to us, otw@2600.com. And maybe your letter will get read out over the air. Dear Emmanuel, as always, thanks for the show. Even if topics are not up my alley, your volunteering commitment is inspiring. On your remarks of the people in Haiti having to behave orderly even after being days without food, I'd like to remind you what stampede we can muster on Black Friday for just a measly discount on a product we do not really need for our survival. And on a side note, you mentioned a few months ago people at Horror donated $100 for the show, which I thought was a small amount. I gave my donation, 50 for Off the Wall and 50 for Off the Hook, during the Horror conference. Just wanted to make sure that was added to the station's donations as well. Thanks, audio guy from Dan Kaminsky's talk at Horror. That's how you signed your letter. And yes, we did receive that. Actually, to correct you, though, you didn't give $50. You gave 50 euros per show. And yes, we did the conversion and made sure that got to the right programs. Thanks so much for doing that. And this goes to show that devoted listeners are out there in so many different ways. And on that subject, tomorrow night on Off the Hook, we're going to be starting our winter fundraiser. So please, if you believe in non-commercial radio, show your support during that period. What else? Dear Off the Wall, it's interesting you're playing this album of old recordings. I DJ for my local college radio station, WRFL, in Lexington, Kentucky. I noticed a few weeks ago a set of vinyls from 1972 that were four discs with the oldest known American and European recordings. Recorded and documented in the book were things dating back to not just gramophones, but recordings from wax cylinders and the like. Really fascinating stuff. It's very interesting to hear the qualities and the timelessness of things like newsreels and music themes through the past 100-plus years. Signed, Vincent. Vincent, thanks so much for writing in with that. And I got to tell you, the best thing you could possibly do is record all of this. Record all this, digitize it, stick it on the Internet, do something to make sure it's preserved beyond that library. We have so many records here that we need to do the same thing for, because you'd be amazed how quickly things go out of print and just are impossible to find. So, yeah, I'd love to hear some of this, some of these old recordings. And finally, Emmanuel, I'm almost 90% positive that sound from the train station is sampled from a song. This is the sound that we played last week and a couple of weeks before that, the sound that turned out to be from Gare du Nord in Paris. This listener writes, I haven't been able to figure out what song this is sampled from, but it's some popular pop song. I painfully watched an entire Lady Gaga song, but that wasn't it. I think this song is more mid-90s, maybe early 2000s. I don't know if you thought to run it through one of those song recognition applications, but I think it might be worth a shot. I'm also not quite sure whether or not the synth sound before the voice is part of the song or not, but I do know that in the song part, the voice part would have a refrain and be repeated. But maybe I'm wrong. Signed, Pierce. Well, Pierce, thanks for making my life even more complicated now. I'm sure somebody out there has that software to basically figure out if something is from a song. But you can find it on last week's show. You can find it on the show 2 weeks prior to that. And unfortunately, that's all the time that we have for tonight. Time just flew by. So next week we'll try this again. And again, write to us, otw@2600.com. We'd love to hear from you. In the meantime, stay tuned to WUSB and non-commercial radio in general. And stay awake, alert, and talking. Hopefully we'll hear from you soon. Have a good night.